Hello and welcome to Debate on Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. Again, the U.S. is being accused of interfering in a sovereign country. This time it is Russia, where some demonstrations have taken place protesting the arrest of opposition figure Alexei Navalny on his return from Germany. Moscow has pointed the finger at Washington and trying to fuel the flames of protests in Russia. This coming at a time that Moscow says it is ready to talk to the Biden administration about improving ties. Well, stay with us as we take a look at all of this on this debate. We're going to start it off in Moscow and talk to our correspondent on the ground there, Marina Kortanova. Marina, great to have you with us. Well, fill us in on this latest situation and the accusations by Moscow of U.S. interference.
So thousands in major cities of Russia yesterday joined protest in support not only of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny, but against impoverishment of the population in the country, lack of production and unemployment, disagreeing with the policy of the current authorities and against the irremovability of the latter, as well as inflation, failed youth and social policy. Some scuffles and detentions took place. As you know, Alexei Navalny is a Russian opposition leader who heads the Anti-Corruption Foundation. He films investigations. Two of the latter caused the greatest resonance in Russian society. Meanwhile, the day earlier, the U.S. Embassy Moscow posted detailed information on its website regarding the time and locations of the mass rallies. Russian presidential spokesman Dmitry Peskov has described these statements as interference in the country's domestic affairs. The U.S. Embassy claimed to monitor the protests across Russia and accused the Russian authorities of suppressing free speech and free assembly. Peskov said that it is hard to imagine if Russian embassy had reacted in such manner when the United States experienced civil unrest. Hmm. Then it would have caused certain discomfort in Washington. He also said that he always feels like recommending counterparts to imagine themselves in such a situation. Earlier, Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs made a statement that such comprehensive information goes beyond the concern about the well-being of U.S. citizens in Russia and goes in line with Washington's provocative and dogmatic policy of encouraging protests in countries whose governments are seen by the United States as undesirable.
Okay.
Any attempt to provide such coverage regarding unauthorized rallies to be deemed as blatant interference in Russia's country's domestic affairs and will provoke an appropriate response.
Okay, Marina, good. Marina, thanks so much for that update on the situation. That's our correspondent in Moscow, Marina Kortanova. I'd like to welcome my first guest to the program, Don DeBar, activist and commentator out of New York. Don, always a pleasure to have you on. Well, Don, it just sounds like copy-paste. I mean, it seems like we've been there before. Your take on all of this and the possibility of U.S. Stirring up the flames there now in Russia.
Well, first of all, thank you, Marzia. A pleasure to be here with you. You know, the Russians with this Novichok poison, and if they wanted to do it right, they should come to the United States. You know, we have Monsanto. They never miss when you want to poison someone. They poison millions at a time. This is the first weekend after the new administration. For 4 years, I've been trying to point out to people and others as well that when we left off on January 19th, 2017, when the Obama administration left off, was with Russia surrounded by U.S. forces from the Baltics to the Korean Peninsula, under constant war games, diplomats being expelled, you know, by the handful, rhetoric that's started in mid, I would say, in 2014. And then in July of 2016, during the campaign, really aggressive, calling Russia every kind of evil and accusing it of attempting essentially to overthrow the government of the United States, which it was claimed by such as Clapper and others, head of CIA, DNI, FBI, that actually had occurred with Donald Trump, that Donald Trump was placed in office on January 20th, 2017 by Vladimir Putin, and that he was his puppet. We heard accusations on the editorial page of the New York Times when Trump met with Putin and didn't punch him in the face, that this was treason. He should be removed and tried, and you know, there's death penalty for treason. So the first weekend after Biden takes office under this cloud, we have an uprising, quote unquote, of several thousand in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and a couple of smaller cities across Russia, coordinated, widely publicized, advance warning, by the way, from the State Department to Americans traveling in Russia that this was going to happen. But the maximum expression of what looks like the beginning of an attempted color revolution in Russia by the United States. That happening on the first day of the Biden administration, we were concerned that they might get aggressive with Russia and even stumble into a war. Is frightening, to use the simple word.
All right. Well, let me welcome my next guest out of London, Jonathan Fryer, author and broadcaster. Thanks so much for being with us, Jonathan. Well, you heard Don kick off the program and say basically we've picked up, it seems, from where the U.S. left off 4 years ago in dealing with Russia. Your take on all this? I mean, it appears very reminiscent of 2014 Ukraine, when the U.S. was exposed for its involvement in protests, and even American officials participated in demonstrations there, cursed the EU for not being on the same page. Your take on this, and why does it seem that Washington uses the same playbook time and time again in different countries?
Well, I tend to feel that it's actually a coincidence that this has happened at the first week of the Biden presidency. We have to remember that it was triggered by Alexei Navalny's return to Russia a few days ago, and then his arrest, and then the demonstrations that have taken place across Russia. I don't think this is an American-inspired counter-protest or color revolution, as Don put it. I think that, frankly, it's quite normal for the Americans to put out a release, as they did to their citizens, to say, avoid these places. There are going to be demonstrations. There will probably be arrests, as indeed there were well over 1,000 people picked up for what was described as an unauthorized protest. But I think actually the climate for U.S.-Russian relations is actually got a boost by the arrival of Biden, who's a much more level-headed figure than Donald Trump ever was. And indeed, the Russians themselves, just over the last 48 hours or so, congratulated Joe Biden for suggesting prolonging the nuclear arms treaty for another 5 years and agreed that that would be a jolly good thing to do.
Well, what about that, Don? Because on the one hand, of course, we saw Trump or the Trump administration do some definitely off-the-wall things. But on the other hand, Trump continually wanted to have good relations with Moscow. But as you said, you pointed out that from the very beginning, he was told that the Russians had tried to interfere in the elections and that he was a spy. It just seemed to be this pull in not allowing that administration to establish closer ties. How do you see it?
First, behavior has to be in the context of votes in Congress. The first being the vote on sanctions, that sanctions bill that was proposed by Congress on its own initiative, adding sanctions against Russia, against Korea, and against Iran to the pile that had already existed, almost directly in response to Trump's pronouncements about Russia, that it would be good if the U.S. and Russia had better relations and not a bad thing. His actual movement towards relations and his visit ultimately to North Korea, and his failure to act on the aggressive rhetoric that he had tossed at Iran up to that point by passing a sanctions bill on the order of 517-6 or something, which is not only veto-proof but practically unanimous. That first vote telegraphed what policy was going to be, and the second one was the vote on his impeachment, which, you know, passed the House, and was close enough in the Senate to be discouraging. He was looking at his foreign policy essentially being at the sufferance of Congress and his removal being an immediate tool that they would have available. And you can look at the speed by which that Ukrainian pause for his ultimate impeachment matured from the occurrence until the actual vote as you know, an indication of how tight a leash he was on. So on the one hand, even though the U.S. Continued to either allow nuclear treaties with Russia to expire and even further abrogated some or withdrew from some, a lot of the content that was actually happening around those had to do with obsolete treaties. For example, you know, the treaty that dealt with cruise missiles was critical in the 1980s, but the technology is obsolete. Now, you can have that treaty in place and still have 9 minutes or so from launch to demolition in Russia or the United States with the weapons that have been developed since. Trump's behavior was that he shut down the war games. That all by itself dropped the level of readiness of troops on both sides and the risk of accidental war, which is where I see the real risk of nuclear war coming, you know, being accidental, but a consequence of, you know, complete total criminal negligence on the part of the United States by forcing a level of hostilities where everything air trigger.
Well, Jonathan, you said that you just thought that all of this is the timing was accidental. I mean, we look at Navalny's return to Russia. This is after accusing the government of being behind his poisoning. Do you not find it curious that he would return and that he would return at this time? And then we see these protests basically sprouting up in various cities?
No, I think it was a reasonable time to go back for him once he had recovered fully from the poisoning that he, and the treatment that he underwent in Germany. So I don't find the timing strange for him to go back to Moscow at this stage. What is really interesting, though, is that whereas Alexei Navalny was very much a fringe figure a few years ago and not all that many people would have supported him, that situation has obviously changed. Because even though, obviously, Vladimir Putin decided that Navalny should not be allowed to contest the presidential election, nonetheless, Navalny has obviously got several thousand supporters. One can't accurately judge how many, who've gone out knowing full well that if they did go out in unauthorized protests, as they're called, they would be likely to get arrested, including his wife, of course, Yulia. So I don't think it's as sinister or as worrying as really one should feel. And I was encouraged by the fact that the Kremlin actually did say, having reprimanded the American embassy for putting out the detail of the route of one of the protests in Moscow, the Kremlin then did say what they hoped was that there would be new talks with Washington and that the way to solve problems is through negotiation. And that I absolutely endorse.
Well, let's talk about that, Don, actually what Jonathan has just said, that in the middle of all of this and seeing these demonstrations basically increase and feeling that the United States is behind him. At the same time, Russian officials have said that they would welcome talks with the Biden administration. Your assessment of that?
First of all, just things in context. If there were kind of media support of the protests that took place in, well, let's even back up. Let's go to the period, say, from December 12th until January 6th, just prior to when the Electoral College met, up until the time that the joint session of Congress took place and the so-called attempted coup, when the guy with the horns and 100 of his friends stormed the Capitol with flags and you know, urine and balloons or whatever else they had. If there were analogous support for that from Russian media to the American audience, to that which has been beamed at the Russian audience in support of Navalny through this entire episode, and any other opposition figure that could be found, you would have a tremendous outcry from the U.S. government that this was constituted, you know, someone like the senator from New Hampshire, for example, that this constitutes an act of war, Gene Shinin. Scale of activity in the United States that provokes, you know, another Patriot Act, essentially. 100 people storm the gates of the Capitol and do nothing other than get shot. One of them beats a cop to death. But, you know, this is something that is blown out of proportion, as if, you know, we were under threat of being taken over by a foreign power. Meanwhile, the support that's given to this, there are parades on behalf of the Communist Party, which gets a third of the vote in every election in Russia, that never make the air in the United States, let alone make Russian air via U.S. media. This is the context for it. What's going on is an attempt by U.S. intelligence agencies to pressure the Russian government with the threat of a color revolution. That's how it's seen in Russia, although the threat is not seen as much as Langley would like it to be, because Navalny really is still a fringe character, and that whatever he represents still has essentially a fringe following. But the attempt has already been made, and the you know, the first shot fired over the bow that, okay, this is a new sheriff in town, and we're coming in for the things we want.
Okay.
It's already been told what they want: the oil, they want the gas, they want the no competition on the global stage, and this is, you know, the first step. And they've already said more of this next week and the week after.
Well, Jonathan, in your perspective, how likely are we to see warmer relations between the U.S. and Russia now during this Biden administration?
I think we can be cautiously optimistic. I don't think we're going to see a great love-in between Washington and Moscow, but I do think the general tenor of Joe Biden's administration, assuming that it's going to be confirmed by the Senate, will be to have friendly relations with Russia, with some other countries around the world that are important in the world economy, and of course with the European Union in particular, which is a slight divergence from Donald Trump's priorities. I think also that we're seeing that Joe Biden very much wants to get away from this idea of America being isolated, being in difficult arrangements with other countries that are not suitable, not conducive to peace. And I'm cautiously optimistic, but I don't think we should go over the top on this. I don't think we should say that we're ushering in a great new era of friendship. I think it's looking good.
Well, even if you, just staying with you, Jonathan, when we look at some of the remarks actually that Don made, and referring to the last administration of Obama, and he said it feels as if we've picked up from where we had left off. Your assessment of that, because if we look at the Democrats in general, what we saw and reaction by the Democrats and others towards Trump and saying that he wanted warmer relations with Moscow, it appears that the Democrats are actually the ones that have been against the warming of this relationship. And if we look at some of the individuals who are going to be serving in the cabinet, whether we're talking about Nuland or others, not a great track record when it comes to Russian affairs.
Well, certainly several of the people who are proposed for the new cabinet are indeed familiar faces from before Donald Trump's time. And of course, Biden was vice president to President Obama, so we maybe shouldn't be surprised by that continuity. So in that sense, yes, we've gone back to a certain period where of people who have the experience of those years. But I do think that nonetheless, the world atmosphere has changed over the last 4 years, and that although Donald Trump said that he wished to improve relations with Moscow, and that he said that he was going to get a nuclear deal with North Korea, which he didn't, despite his high-profile summits. I think we have a recognized situation now where we'll go back to more of a world order in which there are more balanced decisions being taken. And I don't think that Joe Biden himself will want to say anything or do anything that would antagonize Moscow at the moment. We all accept Vladimir Putin is there, and so long as he wants to be there, he's going to remain there, so that it would be ridiculous for any outside power, including the United States, to try to urge people to get rid of him, because they won't. He still has an enormous amount of support.
Okay. Well, Don, can the U.S., in your perspective, establish mutual relations with countries and treat them as equals? Is this possible in your perspective?
I mean, it's always possible. Is it possible with the current leadership? I don't know. We have to look at the context under which this administration comes to power, and how the other one was driven from power. And the primary disagreement between those factions of whatever power elite exists here that was involved in it is over two different worldviews. One that Trump saw more as a multilateral view, where the players all have their own agency, and they're expected to pay their own way, too, by the way. Now, the disagreement, quote-unquote, with the European countries, for example, was actually a disagreement with that part of the European elites that have the Atlanticist point of view, the international view, with the U.S. as a global hegemon and everyone having a respective place as a higher or lower level vassal. The view that Trump had was one more of multilateral, and the view that was in power for a long time since World War II, particularly since 1991, the fall of the USSR, was the hegemonic one. The hegemonic one is now back in power. Where does that leave Russia? It leaves Russia to do what it's told, shut up and sit down, or else. It's like the rest of the world. And unfortunately, I think Russia made a decision a long time ago, certainly since it got control of itself again when Putin came into office, that the last time they were going to allow that to happen was with Operation Barbarossa, that they weren't going to allow anyone to come in and kill 20 or 30 or 40 million Russians again without taking a lot of people out at the head end. And so as they push more aggressively against Russia, and again, I'll remind that what they were doing essentially...
20 seconds, Don.
Wargaming from the Baltics to Korea. Wargame means you start an invasion and stop at the border. The other country has to put its defenses in motion. Well, if you do that and the other country thinks you're coming in and both sides have nuclear war, I don't know another scenario for the end of humanity, but that seems to be about as close as we've mustered so far.
Okay. An unfortunate note to end, but we're out of time. I appreciate both of you being with us. Don DeBar, activist and commentator out of New York, and out of London, Jonathan Fryer, author and broadcaster. And thank you so much for being with us on Another Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Did you really read all those books, or is it just to make an impression?
My sisters love those books. I really think you might like them. And I'm willing to be directed as well.
How much are you familiar with the books in the bookshelves of the Muslim libraries in the world?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salaam alaikum to you, dear brothers and sisters, wherever you are. You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. Since we are in the solar calendar month of Bahman in Iran, which is in fact a commemorator of those times about 42 years ago when the Shah left Iran, or it was expelled out of Iran, and Imam Khomeini arrived. Well, So we decided, in fact, to devote this episode to that Iranian revolution that changed the Middle East and also the world. And also the next episode, hopefully, and inshallah, we are going to talk about a book which is related to the Islamic revolution and Islamic government. So you guessed it right. We're going to talk about the book Islamic Government, Governance of the Jurist, written by Imam Khomeini. Well, as you all know, the Iranian Revolution happened in 1979, right? In these days. A big sweet difference in everyone's life. Many people have been killed, tortured, and many heroes and heroines dedicated their sons and, well, daughters during those days. This book is in accordance to its history, is the translation of Imam Khomeini's book. To elaborate more on it, probably the best known of Imam Khomeini's works, the Islamic Government, Governance of the Jurist, originated in a series of lectures given in Najaf between January 21st and February 8th in 1970. The lectures were recorded and transcribed by a student and then published in a book form, which was called then Islamic Government, as an exact translation of the original Persian title, Hukumat-e-Islami. However, the reader should bear in mind that the book does not purport either a complete scheme of Islamic political philosophy or a detailed plan for the establishment and functioning of an Islamic state. Its purpose is narrower and more specific and geared to the audience to whom the lectures were delivered, students of the religious studies, who might be expected later to assume positions of influence in Muslim society. Then, if you are an eager listener, a student, the inhabitants of this country or elsewhere, any Muslim in the world who wants to know more about this book, we advise you to stay tuned. Let's take a break.
Ayatollah Khomeini led his country in an attempt to restore the Islamic vision. This gathering on the anniversary of his death is evidence of the continuing popular support for the Ayatollah's message. The revolution was one of the most significant events of recent Muslim history. It opposed the West and restored Islam to center stage. It gave a lead to the whole Islamic world and made Muslim governments uncomfortable. But many ordinary Muslims everywhere admired the Ayatollah.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad. Hosting this program, we were introducing the book Islamic Government, Governance of the Jurist. Well, this book, Islamic Government, Governance of the Jurist, has been written by Imam Sayyid Ruhollah Musavi Khomeini and later translated by Hamid Algar. The publication of this book, in fact, is the Institute for the Compilation and Publication of Imam Khomeini's Works, which has been publishing various works of the Imam since 1989. Well, as we talked about earlier, this book was the result or the product of lectures given in Najaf between January 21st and February 8th in 1970. Well, three major points emerged from these lectures. The first, the necessity for the establishment and maintenance of Islamic political power of the Islamic goals, precepts, and criteria. The second is the duty of the religious scholars, the fuqaha, to bring about an Islamic state. The form of this government is the one that is managed to be controlled by the rules of God. However, the third one, a program of action for the establishment of an Islamic state, including various measures for self-reform by the religious establishment. All right? So here were the concepts talked about in this book. And in the next part, we're going to read a short excerpt from this book. Let's take a break.
Allahu Akbar. Khomeini Rahbar, Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in qarn mojza kardid, millat Iran, millat mojza asay qarn ast.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar, Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar, Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Back to the program. Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohammad Jawad. Hosting this program, we were introducing the book Islamic Government, Governance of the Jurist, written by Imam Khomeini. As I promised earlier in the previous section, let me read a very short part from this book. This is the part where Imam Khomeini addresses the younger generation. You, the younger generation in the religious institution, must come fully to life and keep the command of God alive. Develop and refine your thinking and lay aside your concern with the subtleties of the religious sciences, because that kind of concentration on petty detail has kept many of us from performing our more important duties. Come to the aid of Islam, save Islam. They are destroying Islam, invoking the laws of Islam and the name of the most noble messenger, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. They are destroying Islam. Agents, both foreigners sent by the imperialists and natives employed by them, have spread out into every village and religion of Iran and are leading our children and young people astray who might otherwise be of service to Islam one day. Help save our young people from this danger. It is your duty to disseminate among the people the religious knowledge you have acquired and to acquaint them with the subjects you have learned. The scholar or the faqih is accorded praise and glorified in the traditions because he is the one who makes the ordinances, doctrines, and institutions of Islam known to the people and instructs them in the sunnah of the most noble messenger, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. You must now devote your energies to the tasks of propagation and instruction in order to present Islam more fully to the people. It is our duty to dispel the doubts about Islam that have been created. Until we have erased these doubts from people's minds, we will not be able to accomplish anything. We must impress upon ourselves and upon the generation and even the generation after that the necessity for dispelling these doubts about Islam that have arisen in the minds of many people, even the educated among us, as a result of centuries of false propaganda. You must acquaint the people with the worldview, social institution, and form of government proposed by Islam so that they may come to know what Islam is and what its laws are. I hope you enjoyed this program in which we try to introduce the book Islamic Government, Governance of the Jurist, written by Imam Khomeini in the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran,
You're listening to IRIB English Radio. Round the World with Reporters.
The steadfastness of Yemen and the resistance of Palestinians is the slogan of a press conference held by the Yemen-Palestine Organization. Participants discussed Yemeni-Palestinian relations and their common vision, which is resistance against the Zionist projects in the region.
This event is a Yemeni-Palestinian initiative for political awakening and for the unity of both nations to achieve a common goal of defeating the Israeli regime's plans in the region and liberation of Palestine. Israel is our common enemy and the enemy of Muslim nations.
The participants affirmed that Yemen and Palestine have strong ties that transcend geographical borders, as Yemen has become an important part of the axis of resistance. The Yemen-Palestine Organization also revealed its humanitarian plan for 2021, which will contribute to alleviating the suffering of Yemenis due to the continuing war and the blockade imposed by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition.
Yemenis believe that the U.S. as the main supporter of Israel is also responsible for the sufferings of Palestinians and Yemenis. They say resistance is the only way to achieve victory and liberation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Almost 3 months have passed since the beginning of the intra-Afghan talks in Qatari capital Doha. The negotiating team of the Afghan government accuses the Taliban of foot-dragging, but the militant group rejects such allegation.
The negotiating team of the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan is fully ready for talks, but the Taliban side has ignored to attend the meetings over the past 10 days under the pretext of being busy with their own meetings.
In the meantime, this top army official, who usually spends much of his time in front lines, also accuses the Taliban of expanding their attacks amid condemnations by the Afghan people and international bodies like the United Nations. That is why officials here warn that Afghan troops may intensify their attacks on the Taliban if they continue targeting civilians.
Our message to the Taliban is to either grab the current opportunity to bring peace or stop targeting civilians. Otherwise, we will pound their positions across the country and we will kill them one by one.
Despite all ifs and buts regarding the Afghan peace process, what war-weary Afghans want is lasting peace and an opportunity to forget about war, bloodshed and misery they have been suffering for over the last four decades.
We are tired of war. We have one wish, that is to see calm and security in our country. We don't care about either the government or the Taliban, but we want an immediate silence of guns here.
So far, many regional and international players, mainly the US, have declared their full readiness to support any move toward bringing peace to the country.
This comes as many here believe the Afghan peace process has now turned into a good pretext for some local and international players. This is because such a matter allows them to further interfere in Afghanistan's affairs and follow their own interests in this wounded land. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The UK government is mulling over plans to put some travelers coming to England in so-called quarantine hotels amid concerns about new variants of the virus.
As we vaccinate more people, it becomes more and more important that we protect against any new variants coming in. Once you have that protection and you don't have new variants in the country, you should protect against them.
Despite the high death toll, case numbers in the UK are slowly falling thanks to the lockdown. But the government is facing mounting pressure over when the restrictions, among them school closures, will be eased. As for the rest of Europe, well, they're worried about an outbreak of the so-called British variant within their borders.
Different European countries have different measures in place, lockdowns, curfews, but with their healthcare systems under immense pressure, they may have to enforce even stricter measures soon.
But the restrictions of freedoms already in place are testing people's patience. In the Netherlands, at least 150 people arrested Monday during unrest and looting in towns and cities across the country over an 8 p.m. curfew.
Het heeft ook niks te maken wat we zagen met strijden voor de vrijheid. We nemen al deze maatregelen.
What we saw has nothing to do with fighting for freedom. We didn't take all these measures for fun. We did so because we are fighting against the virus, and it's the virus which is actually robbing our freedom.
While the UK heads towards its mid-February target of 15 million vaccinations, across the EU, growing frustration with the pace of immunization. Last week, AstraZeneca told the EU it was falling behind on its supply target because of production problems. The EU Commission, in charge of approving and procuring the jabs, isn't happy.
This new schedule is not acceptable to the European Union. The European Union has pre-financed the development of the vaccine and its production and wants to see the return.
The delays will make it harder for the EU to meet its plan to vaccinate 70% of its adult population by late summer, leading to a deepening of the crisis across the bloc. The UK and European Union have survived Brexit and the financial lockdown of 2008, but it remains to be seen if they will survive COVID-19. Saeed Pariza, London.
Iranian Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif made a stop in Moscow for talks with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov on mutual and international issues. In a joint press conference, Zarif said Iran will take proper action whenever the United States lifts the sanctions to pave the way for its return to the 2015 nuclear deal.
What we have heard from the United States administration so far has mostly been in the form of words and announcements of its position. However, it is actions that we respond to.
For his part, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Moscow and Tehran share the same position on how to preserve the historic deal, adding that it was up to the United States to take the first steps by removing the sanctions.
Both we and Iran are deeply interested in a full return of signatory states to fulfilling their obligations under the accord.
The top Iranian diplomat said Trump's departure brought along special circumstances that required Tehran and Moscow to coordinate their positions in this regard.
Our focus today was on the Caucasus and the regional efforts for bringing peace and stability in the Caucasus, because I am right now engaged in a regional trip to countries in the Caucasus plus Russia and Turkey. We also had a major discussion about global situation and how we can revive the nuclear deal.
With the election of Joseph Biden, hopes for a more balanced approach from Washington and a return to the nuclear deal have been revived.
If this happens, and we hope that we'll be able to achieve such a result, then of course the relations between Iran and the Russian Federation will benefit, since they will be removed from illegitimate, illegal unilateral sanctions, both from the United States and from a number of other countries.
Zarif arrived in Moscow after paying a visit to Azerbaijan, where he sat down with Azeri President Ilham Aliyev.
Iran and Russia said they are determined to expand mutual ties and continue cooperation in regional stability and international security. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Italy's Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte tendered his resignation, throwing Italy into a government crisis in the midst of a pandemic that has devastated the country. More than 85,000 lives have been lost to coronavirus as Italy's economy is falling deeper into chaos. After surviving two confidence votes last week, Conte has reportedly decided to quit because his executive risked being defeated in a vote over a contested report on the justice system in the Senate, where he no longer has an absolute majority.
President of the Republic Sergio Mattarella received this morning the President of the Council of Ministers Giuseppe Conte. who handed in the resignation of the government that he presides. The President of the Republic has decided to invite the government to remain in charge to handle the current affairs.
The government was plunged into crisis after former Prime Minister Matteo Renzi pulled his junior partner Italia Viva out of the ruling coalition on January 13. Renzi had withdrawn his support over issues including differences on the COVID-19 recovery plan and the handling of the coronavirus outbreak. Conte is now expected to seek a third mandate from the President of the Republic Sergio Mattarella to form a new executive with a broader coalition. Should he fail to do so, Mattarella may decide to bring in a new prime minister or call for snap elections.
La risposta è molto semplice.
I'm going to make this very simple. This political crisis will result in more interest to be paid by Rome on its public debt due to an increase of the spread between Italy and Germany's 10-year yields. Whoever becomes prime minister next will have to implement tough reforms, including slashing health and social spending, in order to access the resources allocated in the EU's recovery fund.
On Wednesday, Italy's head of state, Mattarella, is slated to start a round of formal consultations with party leaders and other institutional figures to see whether a new coalition can be formed.
It isn't certain where this political crisis will lead. What is certain is that not even the world's worst pandemic in a century has persuaded the Italian politicians to remain united to face an unprecedented health crisis together. After the collapse of 66 governments in just 75 years of democracy, the country's future is now in the hands of President Mattarella. Max Civili, Rome.
Streets were deserted, shops were closed, and businesses were abandoned in Indian-controlled Kashmir as India celebrated its 72nd Republic Day.
What is there for the people of Kashmir to celebrate? Our special status was stripped, and so were our rights. The promises that were made were just a show-off. Our jobs, our land, and our opportunities are on sale. So what should I celebrate?
Amid suspended internet services and heightened security arrangements, authorities have held a symbolic Republic Day parade in a highly secured sports stadium in the heart of Srinagar. Indian-controlled Kashmir came under India's absolute control after New Delhi stripped Kashmir of its special status in August 2019. Following the move, pro-freedom groups in the disputed region were detained so that any dissent against India's decision would be prevented.
The democratic values for which the India is advocating and India is calling in the world that it is the biggest democracy, they are not following it actually on ground. Democracy gives the right of dissent.
Although New Delhi says the revocation of Article 370 was to integrate Jammu and Kashmir into the rest of India for easier development and equal opportunity for the citizens, analysts say the reality on the ground is quite the opposite.
After revocation of Article 370, which was one of the articles of the Constitution of India, the government's attitude has been more aggressive and arrogant, not people-friendly. There is no democracy on ground. The democratic setup has been closed down and an authoritative setup has been put in, which is working with a dictatorial attitude. And the people are suffering.
By staying indoors on India's Republic Day, people of Kashmir have once again displayed their level of alienation. Analysts say India needs to take necessary steps and fulfill its promises in order to win their hearts. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
The cities are the most important human habitat in the modern era. They show the extent of civilization, social life, and the blossoming of the capabilities of the citizens. Today, that geographical boundaries do not exist thanks to the modern communication technologies, better urban management techniques can be identified through sharing global experiences. The municipality of Tehran has been a pioneer in hosting international events since 2014 and has brought together academic and executive elites in the field of urban management from all over the world to provide a forum for exchanging urban experiences. The fifth edition of the Tehran Golden Adobe Global Award was held at a time that the whole world is hit by the spread of the coronavirus.
Amid the corona pandemic, we were in touch with the mayors of many major cities of the world to share experiences. We informed them about the tough situation of Iran, where it is hit by the cruel sanctions on the one hand and the corona problems on the other hand. We used urban symbols like Azadi Square to sympathize with those struggling with the pandemic. Via video mapping, we were the first city to sympathize with those hit by the virus in China's Wuhan.
Some distinguished foreign guests who were present at the closing ceremony of Tehran Golden Adobe Award also touched upon the role of urban management at critical times.
We have to think that COVID has imposed new expectations but also new realities, and we have to look at capacities for a new digital age. And finally, it's not only about capacities, it's also about the agency, the institutions. So we have to look at how government and institutions operate in this context and how we can look at more healthier, greener and equitable policies.
At the end of the ceremony, Tehran's Global Award for Urban Management in different categories was handed to the best project in the cities, regions, and local communities worldwide. Tehran Golden Adobe Award is a comprehensive, academic, non-profit initiative that specializes in international urban management research and exchange. However, due to the spread of the coronavirus, this edition focused on methods used by urban managers to cope with the pandemic. Human Abadi, Tehran.
In yet another effort to stop Saudi Arabia's devastating war in Yemen, this time 24 British Parliament members have urged Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab to halt the country's arms sales to Riyadh. In a letter, they have underlined that up to £15 billion worth of UK-made arms have been sold to the Saudi regime since it launched a war on Yemen in 2015. The letter also cites a recent UN report on the situation in Yemen, adding that the war has already claimed 233,000 lives, while about 24 million Yemenis are in dire need of humanitarian assistance. Many political experts believe that the Saudi-led war is being perceived globally as unwarranted and genocidal.
The global perception now about the Yemen war, if nothing else, is that this was unwarranted and genocidal. I mean, there's no justification for it. And it was a Saudi assault, but orchestrated by UK and US military personnel. Officers were in the Saudi capital from the very beginning, and of course all the weaponry that the Saudi military uses in this genocidal assault is US and UK military hardware.
Since 2015, the Saudi-led bombing and blockade of Yemen have devastated much of the poor country's infrastructure, with the UN calling it the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Half of Yemen's population is now on the brink of famine, many of them children. The country has also experienced the world's worst cholera outbreak and now struggling with an alarming COVID-related death rate. From the onset of war, many international rights groups and activists have slammed the West in general and the United States, Britain, France, and Canada in particular for their support for the Saudi-led coalition. They have repeatedly called on these governments to suspend weapon sales to Riyadh and Abu Dhabi to avoid a humanitarian catastrophe in Yemen. In September, a UN experts group named Canada for the first time as the one perpetuating the conflict in Yemen by selling arms to Saudi Arabia. So far, international calls have fallen on deaf ears as not only Saudi Arabia continues with its bombing campaign and blockade of Yemen, but its Western backers too continue supplying the regime with lethal weapons. It seems that what matters to Western powers most is putting their profit out of arms exports to their repressive Arab regimes above human rights and the lives of millions of impoverished Yemenis.
The Democrat-led lower house of Congress has forced a second impeachment trial in the Senate for ex-President Donald Trump on charges of incitement of insurrection following the deadly protests inside Capitol Hill on January 6th. There is seemingly no chance that a supermajority two-thirds of the Senate, which is evenly split between both parties, will vote to convict Trump this time either. Recent polls show America is almost evenly split on if Trump deserves a conviction, meaning the trial will be yet another highly divisive political event.
I think Democrats are basically taking this opportunity to once and for all kind of like rally around that, like, this person is, like, you know, evil, he's bad for the system, this is a terrible president to send. They're really just trying to hammer down that you can't get away with this stuff. This, and the president in his own words really did, like, rile up these people to come to the Capitol and, you know, wreak havoc. It's more of, I think, what they're going towards is, like, you can't come here and touch us.
Analysts suggest that Democrats may be pushing the trial as a way to weaken the Republican Party. By forcing Republicans to openly choose between pro-Trump and anti-Trump factions, conservatives could be weakened by infighting for years. Trump remains incredibly popular among Republicans, but a conviction would forbid him from holding office and running for president in 2024. Given the record anger, disunity, and polarization, many wonder if a successful conviction could backfire and provoke even greater problems.
All it really does is creates a vacuum for another figurehead to kind of go in there and take control of this mob of quite literally fascists. This is like fascism in actual definition. And what this does is, you know, we know Trump is a con man. We know Trump was often like bumbling his way through things. He was kind of like, you know, a joke, a mockery of the system. This unfortunately creates a vacuum where someone more competent in terms of just, you know, oppression, repression, can take control of this vacuum that Trump is leaving behind.
New President Joe Biden is being criticized for allowing Congress to focus on a trial instead of creating legislation to cope with a raging pandemic and a once-in-a-century economic disaster. Many fear the controversial trial will eliminate willingness for bipartisanship in a Congress in which Democrats have only a very slim margin of control. That's a different agenda than Franklin Delano Roosevelt's first 100 days in 1933, when he rolled out 15 major pieces of legislation, which began the so-called New Deal and economic recovery. The trial will begin on February 8th and must dominate the proceedings of Congress until its conclusion weeks later. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in gharn mojza kardid. ملت ایران ملت معجزه آسای قرن است.
الله اکبر خمینی رهبر. الله اکبر خمینی رهبر.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners to our program, The Man Who Changed the World. And, of course, he changed all our tomorrows. And this is a biographical program about the life and times of Imam Khomeini. May God bless his great soul. Today's program is a continuation of the biographical account of Imam Khomeini's life. And we're going to start looking into depth about his personality. And we're going to begin it by looking at the fact, by the recent speeches of the Supreme Leader, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, who has said the following about Imam Khomeini. And this is what is going to start off our discussion today with our guest in the studio as well, our expert in the studio, who is Dr. Hassani. And he's going to help us discuss this biographical account through the words of the Supreme Leader. And the Supreme Leader says the following about Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul. He said he was an accomplished scholar a mujtahid at a very early age, philosopher, poet, arif, which means he's a mystic. He was also combined with astute insight into politics, and of course, as a believer, he was ahead of his time in terms of the